A Waikato Thing, Episode 3, Volcano Part 2.
If I've been standing here in 95, 96, looking up at the summit of Ruapehu, Ruapehu would have been putting on a spectacular display. Huge billowing clouds of ash and little bits of scoria raining out of the sky. Falling, pitter-pattering, all around the ski field. Kia ora, ko Ben Kennedy, tōku whenua. I'm Ben. I am a professor at the University of Canterbury in the lovely Otatahi Christchurch, and I study how volcanoes erupt. So as you walk around Whakapapa ski field, you'll hear this sound. And this is the sound of a past eruption. Under your feet, there are small golden brown, grey bits of scoria. Not that dissimilar to the type of stuff you might buy in a garden centre. Most people, these are just probably annoying, makes the ground a little bit unstable, makes you more likely to slip as you're walking around. But to a volcanologist, this is a huge part of the puzzle of working out what this maunga has done in the past. These bits of scoria, there's not many of them around actually, and I can look super closely and I can see tiny little bubbles and crystals in these bits of scoria. And these bubbles and crystals tell a story that started in the magma chamber and it finished when it fell out of the sky and landed right here under my feet. In 95 and 96, the eruption at Ruapehu, where I'm sitting now, most of the research that we've done has not discovered many blocks and bombs. But what I mean by that is rocks that are kind of fist size. We haven't found that. They're the kind of things that could do damage to a roof, could smash a window. None of those really traveled further than the kind of tops of the chairlifts on the ski field. So if you have a house out in Taupō, you can safely assume that you're not going to have rocks flying through your windows and landing on your couch. These bits of scoria are the only piece of evidence that there was an eruption at Ruapehu in 1995-1996. And maybe in 1940s as well. Ruapehu in the past has had other eruptions. And this very thin layer of scoria that we see relating to 95-96 episode is almost insignificant compared to these bigger eruptions that have taken place in Ruapehu's history, where there may have been scoria raining out of the sky for days, creating thick accumulations, not just here on the flanks of Ruapehu, but all around. And we use this information to communicate with emergency managers, to scientists, GNS science, who monitor the volcano, to prepare for other scenarios that Ruapehu can produce in the future.
A lot of people tend to think of this area when there's snow on the field, so skiing and snowboarding. But for a volcanologist, the summertime when we don't see the snow, we see the rocks and we see a moving landscape. So at the moment, I'm sitting on what a very long time ago would have been a hot lava flow making its way down the volcano. And if we look over here, we actually see cross sections of lava flow stacked on top of each other. And you see how this volcano was actually built up over time, over these progressive eruptions over thousands of years. And here we get to walk across these landscapes and see in our mind the videos and hear the sound of what these lava flows might have actually looked like to form this amazing landscape that most people have different connections to. We can look up in the mountain and we see the scars of when there have been landslides and massive collapse events that have produced material that has run out all the way down to the bottom. We see old lava flows that have been incised and we can see the middle of them. We see the inside of what the volcano looked like a very long time ago, as multiple vents were erupting different material, pyroclastic flows, lava flows, ash fall that would have gone much, much further north or south, depending on the wind direction. And we can see that the way not only the rock moved, but the way that it cooled. When we see columnar jointing in the lava, we get more information about what that volcanic eruption did. When we take pieces of rock back to the laboratory, we can understand what the magma was doing before it erupted, what led to this eruption, how were crystals forming within the melt as the lava was flowing down the volcano. We can understand the dates of when these happened, get an idea of the lifetime of this ancient volcano. And we can use all of that to understand what might happen next.
So I literally dream about what's happening underneath volcanoes. It's remarkable that volcanologists don't actually know what magma chambers look like under the earth and underneath volcanoes. But sometimes we're lucky and we get a little window of what that might look like. And the pinnacles on Ruapehu are one of those windows. So I can look up at the pinnacles, which are on the left as you're looking up at Whakapapa ski field. And there are these beautiful red colors. And then there are these big kind of chunky gray colors. And this is an amazing window inside the volcano. You can imagine a giant god has come with his birthday cake slicer and he's sliced his volcano-shaped birthday cake down the middle and he's looking at the insides of that volcano. And what this shows is inside the volcano, magma, which is molten rock, was crystallizing, so slowly cooling, becoming stickier and stickier, and trying to find its way through an incredibly complicated pathway through rocks and cracks towards the surface. And sometimes that's represented by a steep grey wall of crystalline rock. Sometimes that is represented by a kind of messy mass of rock that some of it is red and it's almost changed to clay. And this represents this mixture that happens, a mixture of fluids that happen inside a volcano. I mean, it's like a birthday cake disaster where your cake should have solidified but it hasn't and it's all gone squishy and some bits have kind of solidified, some bits haven't. And it's like that inside a volcano. There's magma that's hardening and forming rock, but there's also acidic fluids that are dissolving rock and turning it into mushy clay. And there are areas where these acidic fluids may be turning to gas, leaking out the side of the volcano. And there are areas where this magma does make it to the surface, forms a volcanic vent, and maybe either feeding a flow of lava down the side of the volcano, or feeding an explosion that's lofting hot gas and ash up into the atmosphere, rising up above the volcano and falling like snow on the flanks of the volcano and in the surrounding countryside.
As a volcanologist, I've had several projects that I've really loved to be part of in my career. In the period from 2000 to 2017, I worked with many colleagues to develop the first map and eruptive history published on Ruapehu and Tongariro volcanoes. And the takeaway from that one is that these volcanoes were shaped by fire and ice. They're not typical pointy stratovolcanoes like you might draw when you're at school. And there's a reason for that. 95% of their lives have been spent under ice until the end of the ice ages about 12,000 years ago when the ice has retreated. The reason Ruapehu is such a hackly, beautiful landmass is because lava and ash have been fighting it out with ice for most of its history. It was never a symmetrical cone, and the same is true for Tongariro. In fact, if you look at Narahoe, Narahoe is the landform that you create once the ice has gone. Magma's been leaking through in the area around Narahoe for a couple of 100,000 years, but Narahoe wasn't able to form until the ice retreated. The main difference between Ruapehu and Tongariro is the distribution of many vents at Tongariro compared to Ruapehu, which really just has two summit vents that are close together. The really active one right now, Crater Lake, and the plateau just a little bit to the north. Whereas at Tongariro, you have maybe a dozen or more vents spread out in a line from Tamari and Blue Lake right through Narahoe. And those, we think, are probably spread out, perhaps spread out because of faulting. When you look at Tongariro, there's also fault lines running through the whole volcano, and they're not at Ruapehu. So perhaps the fault lines in Tongariro are allowing the magma to spread out along the faults and pop up in more locations. And Narahoe, or Mount Doon from Lord of the Rings, is just one of those locations. The whole volcano is Tongariro from Tamari right through Narahoe. We just tend to focus on Narahoe because it's such a beautiful cone, but the whole volcanic complex is the volcano, the wider Tongariro, all the way from Tamari in the north through to Narahoe. The supervolcano system from Taupoa to Tarawera, known by Mana Whenua as Ahi Tupua or Te Ahi Tupua, is the big brother to Yellowstone and a focus of global public attention. We've been running for 6 years through to 2023, a nationwide research program that brings in scientists and emergency managers from throughout the country to understand the system more, called Eclipse, Eruption or Catastrophe, Learning to Implement Preparedness for Supervolcano Eruptions. And spoiler alert, one of the main things is being prepared for the activity of these volcanoes that are not super eruptions. From all of the research that we've done, there are six things that are really fascinating and really important to know. Number one, caldera volcanoes are beautiful, but they can be dangerous. So when you're visiting, follow signs to stay safe. And those signs are going to be at the geothermal areas and hydrothermal areas throughout the area from Taupoa through to Rotorua and Tarawera. Most of your risk, your safety, comes from walking close to these natural features, these boiling hot pools, mud pools and steaming ground. And the local signage will keep you safe.
You know, being in the outdoor environment in New Zealand, the climate changes is the big one. Particularly getting wet and cold, that the weather can change very fast, and you can go from a quite pleasant environment into a wet and damp environment where hypothermia becomes your enemy. That can happen. The other is if you take on the big climbs, the Taranakis, the Narahoes, Ruapehus, you're starting to get up to moderate to high altitudes. You're getting above 7,000 feet, you're getting close into 9,000 feet at Ruapehu. So you're starting to get into that area where altitude starts to impact on you. The air's a little bit thinner and it's a little bit harder. And I've certainly noticed if I walk up Mount Ruapehu for a day's work, I'm much more acclimatised than if I get flown up. If I fly up, jump out of the helicopter, pick up a spade and start digging a hole, I'm puffing and panting and stuffed. Whereas if I've walked up the volcano, I'm acclimatised a lot better for that day. The risks associated with working around a volcano or visiting a volcano, they're relative. Our work environment is really quite different. It's a bit like a fireman. Most people are running away from the fire, and the fireman's running towards it. He is trained, or she is trained, to deal with a fire. They know what the risks are associated with it. It's very much the same for us. We understand the risks associated with a volcano or a geothermal system. So it's the same with the volcano. People are self-evacuating or being precautionary and moving away from the volcano. We're doing the exact opposite. We're going towards it. I can be happily walking around in a geothermal system, with 80, 90 degree C pools nearby on warm ground. Some people, you know, that's way outside their comfort zone. They would not be there. There are some things you learn some lessons along the way, and there's some things, you know, a little bit embarrassed of some of the places I may have been when I was younger, a little bit more gung-ho. You know, as you mature, have families, your risk profile changes. With experience, you know, you learn about areas that you can and can't be in, or should or shouldn't be in, and that you sort of adapt that to the situation. You know that volcanoes can throw rocks 3 or 4 kilometres. So yes, you go to the volcano, but you stop at 3 or 4 kilometres.
Number 2. Steam, smells, boiling water, and earthquake activity are normal for caldera volcanoes. You'll see these things and you'll have periods where they're more and less active over years to decades throughout that whole central North Island area. That's really normal behaviour. Point 3. Caldera volcanoes, although often called supervolcanoes, usually have small eruptions, which can be dangerous in our lifetimes, but they're manageable. For example, at Taupo, we have seen in the last 12,000 years 25 eruptions. That's eruptions every few hundred years. And all but one of those eruptions has been big but manageable, not too unlike the 95 and 96 eruptions from Ruapehu, but coming through Lake Taupo in most cases. An eruption in Lake Taupo might look different depending on where it happens. Lake Taupo is quite deep in some places, well more than 100 metres, and an eruption starting in those areas we might not even notice until we saw big pieces of floating pumice. If it came through the Horomatangi reefs or other shallow areas, we could have explosions from magma and water interacting and flying rocks and some hot ash clouds. So it is important through the GeoNet program and through the wider New Zealand Volcano Science Advisory Panel for us to be watching and providing advice on the types of activity that can happen at Taupo and for emergency management to be making decisions close to the lake. Number 4, very big eruptions, super eruptions, are unlikely in our lifetimes. In fact, is almost a 0% chance in your lifetime of seeing these. To build up enough magma for a super eruption, we'd expect a lot of steaming ground, ground deformation and earthquakes beyond what we're seeing year to year at the moment. And we'd need that to go on for a couple of hundred years. Think about that now. An average person's lifetime might be 80 years. Imagine your whole lifetime seeing elevated shaking, steaming all over the place and ground deformation in an area. And while that's dramatic, we can be reassured that yes, it could have eruptions, but they're at the smaller, dangerous, but manageable end of the spectrum. When we say build up enough magma a few kilometres down, it's useful to understand the plumbing system inside and below a volcano. We have volcanoes around the Ring of Fire because the Pacific Plate is subducting under the plates all around the edge. It's subducting under the North Island, and a chemical reaction happens at about 100 kilometres down. That subducting plate gives off a little bit of water, and it melts a few percent of the mantle, the rock under the crust, 100 kilometres down. And that rising magma is what's driving the line of volcanoes from all the way from Ruapehu to Tonga. And it rises and stalls at lots of places on the way up. Most of that magma stalls at 20 to 30 kilometres down. And that's kind of what we call the factory. Every now and then, it rises in little bursts to shallow, pancake-shaped magma chambers. They're a few, you know, they're 5 to 10 kilometres down. And that's the place, that's the launching area before an eruption. So to be concerned about an eruption, we're interested in magma arriving at that 5 to 10 kilometre zone, that launching area, or more importantly, it rumbling and rising more shallowly than that, that it might be coming towards the surface. When magma rises in the system, we are able to see symptoms of that at the surface, almost like a patient. We've got our stethoscopes out there, we've got seismometers, we've got ground deformation, GPS sensors, and we can see gas chemistry changes at the Earth's surface. So magma rising up into those chambers at 5 to 10 kilometres, we see earthquakes often when that rise happens, and we see earthquakes and other signals often when the magma chamber itself has magma moving around or potentially rising. For example, recently in 2022 and into 2023, we raised the alert level for the first time at Taupo Volcano, saying we'd gone to minor unrest. And that's because we could see the earthquakes. We're down in that 5 to 10 kilometre range, and we could see some deformation around Lake Taupo and on the Horomatangi reefs, suggesting that there was a bit of deformation and magma was moving around. We weren't seeing it necessarily shallower than that, and it was at the end of the spectrum where we see that every few years to decade. But it's enough, and we know enough from recent research to be able to say, yes, that probably is magma moving around in the system, and that's normal. This is a natural process. Maybe every 50 to 100 years, it rises to moderate to heightened unrest, and we get more concerned. And then every few hundred years, that might actually lead to an eruption. Number five, understand your relationship with your local caldera volcano. This is especially important in the Waikato and Bay of Plenty regions, where people are living beside and on top of these caldera volcanoes. Where do you live in relation to the calderas? Are you living next to Lake Taupo? Are you living in the Rotorua Basin? Do you use power? Hydro and geothermal power are a notable part of our renewable energy for the whole country. 15 to 20% of our electricity is coming from geothermal at the moment in New Zealand. Geothermal heat is also being used to grow vegetables and flowers and provide direct heat throughout the region. And how are you interacting with your caldera landscape? It's really a geothermal landscape. There are hot springs that you can bathe in or visit to look at the beautiful colours throughout the region, from the Bay of Plenty coast right down through to Tongariro National Park. The Waikato region is really blessed with hot springs. You've also got outlying hot springs that aren't directly coming from the volcanoes, like at the coast around Kawhia or up in the Coromandel at Hot Water Beach. In that case, you've got rainwater getting down alongside fault lines and then coming back up along those faults and giving you nice warm places to bathe. And be aware of the safety and forecastability across the different types and magnitudes of volcanic activity throughout the region. A lot of the safety in the caldera volcanoes is around following those signs in the hot spring and geothermal areas. And if you're down at Tongariro National Park, Department of Conservation has ample signage and information about the small but real chance of a sudden eruption in that park at any time. Number six, anyone can be a scientist. And we get better outcomes for all of society when science considers people and their cultures. Science often seems out of reach, but the reality is little kids are great scientists. Science is about being structured in what you're looking at and thinking in a structured and quantitative way about the environment around you, and then asking critical questions. The scientific method is just coming up with an idea and then testing, looking at your environment and testing your idea to see if you can prove it wrong and if you can come up with a better idea. Kids are great at this, and the challenge is just for us to not lose the ability to be a good scientist as we grow into adults.
So Ahitupua, or the Taupo Volcanic Zone, extends also offshore into our volcanoes such as Tua and Whakaari, and then beyond into the Kermadec arc all the way up to Tonga. So as part of the Beneath the Waves research program, we're investigating these two nearshore volcanoes, Tuhua and Whakaari, to assess what the hazards they contain are and what their impact of those hazards might be on the Bay of Plenty coast. To do this, we've undertaken four research voyages on the RV Tangaroa. It's about 60 days worth of ship time. We've done airborne ground-based surveys measuring all sorts of geophysical, geological measurements. And from these, we hope to understand things like where the magma systems of these volcanoes are, where the hydrothermal systems are, where the weak rocks are, where the strong rocks are, and also then understand if these weak rocks were to fail and fall into the ocean, what sort of tsunami would be generated, and then what would the potential impact of that be on the Bay of Plenty coastline. So the ultimate aim is that we can understand these hazards to better mitigate their impact on, reduce their impact on coastal communities in the North Island. So as scientists, we're really interested in all the scientific findings we're discovering from our voyages and surveys, but what we're equally trying to do is to translate those science findings into things that are useful for communities who live along like the Bay of Plenty coast, the Coromandel coast, that could also be impacted by eruptions from Tuhua, the Coromandel, Western Bay of Plenty, and Whakaari in the Eastern Bay of Plenty. One of those things that we're doing is coming up with novel approaches of education, and for that we're using a gaming approach. So one of the games we've developed is called the 5-Minute Volcano, and in this, it's designed for kind of school kids. In this card game, school kids can play an actor. They could be the volcano, they could be different members of the community, they could be a kaumātua or a civil defense person or a school teacher or a parent or another kid. And their job in that game is to learn how the volcano works and try and defeat the volcano from erupting. And they've got 5 minutes to do it. So that's one. And along the way, they're using, they're learning about the volcano and the hazard processes that can exist at these volcanoes. So not only for creating games for students, but we've also done a lot of work to create resources for teachers. These can be found on the Science Learning Hub, which is a key teaching resource website for teachers. And we've got several civil online activities that we've developed in there. One of them is around modeling tsunamis in a sandpit, just using a simple plastic sandpit with a bunch of sand and some water, making shapes of volcanoes and seeing how these volcanoes fail. We can put a balloon underneath the sand, blow it up like a volcano, see the different parts of the volcano fall off into the water. Those waves travel across the sandpit and we can see how they might impact the shore. There's another game there called Magma Pop. This is where we're trying to actually we're down in the volcano in the magma reservoir and we're trying to simulate an eruption. So we're adding, it's a bit like a bake-off. We're baking, mixing together all the ingredients that we need, the gas, the different types of lava and crystals and magma that we need to make an eruption occur. And then there's another one there called Magma Drillers Save Planet Earth. And this is all about trying to drill into a magma reservoir to understand what's going on in there. And that's actually taken from an example in Iceland where they accidentally did drill into a magma reservoir while they were exploring for geothermal energy. So we've taken these kind of real-time, real-life science events and science knowledge and turned them into gaming approaches to kind of simplify the concepts and help understand, helps the students to understand what these underground processes look like and how they happen. And these are resources that we've got made for teachers so that they can help teach the students for them. So if you've got kids who are interested in volcanoes or science in general, you can go to places like the Science Learning Hub website, and you can search for all sorts of resources around volcanoes, earthquakes, tsunamis, and so on. You can also look at our Beneath the Waves website, and we've also got links to these resources here.
It's often said when you're at university, the best way to learn is to teach. And I've always really taken up that challenge and enjoyed it. It's really important to teach and communicate if you're generating new knowledge or if you hold knowledge. And I find it really enjoyable. So I think everyone can pass on knowledge to their friends and family. And it's a really rewarding thing to do. And no one should be scared to do that. Just learn up on any topic, for example, the topics in these podcasts, and be the person who passes on that information to others. And in doing so, you'll learn it better yourself. I'm a dad, and I really enjoy trying to explain my science to kids. Trying to explain how a volcano works can be a bit challenging. One fun thing that's easy to do, and you could try at home, is to show how magma can go from a liquid to an explosion and a column of ash in the atmosphere using a bottle of Coke and a tube of Mentos. You've probably heard of this before, and you should definitely give it a go. And here's how you explain it. You take the bottle of Coke, and you take the lid off, and you explain, this is magma, just like magma in the ground, and it's got dissolved gas in it. Now, if the magma flows out gently, like this Coke, you could even pour a little bit out, it'll flow across the ground, and that's a lava flow. But if for some reason, suddenly all that gas needs to burst out of the magma in one go, and it can't do it, it can't just bubble off fast enough, it'll blow the magma apart. The bubbles in the Coke will blow the Coke apart, and the Mentos act as a catalyst for that happening. So you take a bottle of Coke, you pop it on the ground, you take a full roll of Mentos, I recommend, and put them inside a tube, and you drop that whole tube into the bottle of Coke at once, and you watch it catalyzing more bubbles than the coke can handle in one go, and the bubbles will blow the coke apart. Those bubbles will blow the magma apart and cause an explosive eruption up into the air. Just like the gas at the top of, for example, Ruapehu volcano would blow the magma apart and create an ash column up into the atmosphere. If you want to learn about a couple of things close to my heart, you can have a look in the links attached to this podcast. One is a demonstration of how calderas work. So I started out learning about caldera volcanoes, and they're really hard to explain, and I won't try here. But I've got two links actually there. One is a paddling pool experiment that shows how calderas work and might generate tsunamis offshore. And the other one is a video that we developed for Te Papa, for the Whakarua Moko part of the Te Taiao Nature New Exhibit at Te Papa. And that is a movie that shows the formation of Lake Taupo in the super eruption about 27,000 years ago, and also what's going on in the magma chamber underneath the ground, the formation of this big pancake of magma under the ground that drove that super eruption. I never thought I'd be a scientist. I always thought I'd probably be a builder. But as I was coming through school, and especially university, I was fascinated by how things work. And so the types of things I studied kind of followed that trend. Maybe I meant to be an engineer. I took at university a wide range of things. I took engineering, I took forestry, I took biology, I took sociology, I took geology and geography. And I realized the common theme across all of those is trying to understand how things work. And the other big piece of, so I'm really following what I'm interested in. I think that's a take home. Follow what you're interested in, and you'll study it just naturally because you're curious. I also took opportunities, and you just got to recognize opportunities are cropping up all the time. I was really lucky. There's a great professor, now retired, at Canterbury, Jim Cole, in volcanology. And as I was coming through, I was getting fascinated in how the planet works. And maybe I should just stick with or start with geology and get to understand how the planet formed and how the planet works. So geography and geology, as I was coming through university, became a focus. And then there was an opportunity with Jim to study volcanoes. And turns out the planet is made out of volcanoes. When the planet formed, it formed from a ring around the early stage sun. And that ring formed up under gravity into a ball. And it was a ball of magma, of molten rock. And then early on, it crusted over. That's our crust. And that crust has just been going ever since through volcanoes. So early on, there were many volcanoes pushing magma up through that crust. And so everything we see on the Earth is actually born of magma and born of volcanoes. So I just thought I'd start with volcanoes, and I've really never left. The other really interesting thing from that point is if we realize everything on the planet is born of volcanoes, that means humans are too. The spark of life, the origin of life, we do fuck a papa to volcanoes. And actually, it's really interesting to realize that science really only got to that point in the last 100 or 200 years. Mataranga Māori has been aware that we fuck a papa to mountains and especially volcanoes for a much longer period of time.
What's the funeral? Awesome question. Okay. My awesome artistic skills have illustrated some...
So half of my job is doing research, trying to work out why and how volcanoes erupt. But another half of my job, and half of my job I'm really passionate about, is about teaching. We are working with a large group of students from the University of Canterbury and some Frontiers Abroad, study abroad students from the United States. And together we are learning about volcano science, we're learning about hazard and risk, and we're learning about rocks. We're super lucky to stay in some of the ski chalets, which are all pretty much empty at the moment because there's not many skiers skiing down this snow-free slope in front of me. So the students are on their way to becoming geologists, volcanologists, and hazard managers. Do research on volcanoes all over the world. There are students who have taken my course in the past that are working full-time at GNS Science, helping with the monitoring team, that are working as technicians at GNS Science, helping install equipment on volcanoes. There are students who are working with hazard maps and communicating volcano science. But there are also a lot of students that will go on to jobs working as geotechnical engineers, students who hunt for water. Our planet needs water, and we need geologists to find that water.
especially in a country like New Zealand where we have a lot of volcanic rocks. You need to understand those volcanic rocks and how they might store water. There are students who will become geothermal scientists, solving our energy problems for the planet. And so geology is a subject that we need in order to find sustainable solutions for our planet going forward. It's not just about managing the hazards of the volcano, it's about finding solutions for the resources that we need to live our lives on this planet.
As part of the Beneath the Waves program, we're sponsoring House of Science volcano kits. And these are kind of teaching resources that are available for schools to use for like volcano teaching modules. And so the kits are fairly expensive. So we've sponsored creating a couple of extra kits, especially for schools in the Waikato region, so that they can increase the teaching on volcano. That's through House of Science. And we're also sponsoring three MSc students at Te Whare Wānanga or Awanui Arangi to undertake a master's program. And those students are affiliated with Tuhua and Whakaari, not only from the science point of view, but also from the Te Ao Māori point of view.
A really important part of being a volcanologist, in my view, is the compassion we have and the want to help people. What is the point of all of our science if we can't give it to the communities who need it most? So being a small girl from Te Awamutu who knew no scientists and didn't know the first thing about becoming a volcanologist or even what that meant, I just knew that that was the path for me. And that's something that I think is so important to tell our kids and adults. You can be what you want to be. You might have additional challenges. You might have chronic illnesses. You might have family situations. Keep at it and believe in yourself. It's so important. I never could have imagined the journey that I've taken, and it still keeps taking wild paths that I don't see coming. But just keep going. It's so important. You can make such a difference.
This was Episode 3, Volcano Part 2, featuring, in order of appearance, from the University of Canterbury, Professor Ben Kennedy, volcanologist and science communicator Dr. Janine Krippner, GNS Science lead scientist for natural hazard and risk and lead for the Beneath the Waves Endeavour Project, Graham Leonard, GNS Science volcanologist Brad Scott, senior volcano geophysicist for GNS Science and lead for the Eclipse Endeavour Program, Craig Miller. For more information, check out the links on our show notes page at waikatocivildefence.govt.nz/podcast. Produced and directed by Drew Mertens. Production partner, LeBlue. Copyright 2024, Waikato Civil Defence Emergency Management Group. Next, Earthquake.